Get by and see.
Welcome into You're the Cure right here on AM 580 with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, of course, Veritas Medical. Check out our website, veritasmedical.com. You can always go there and research past programs. We have them archived at our website, veritasmedical.com. Let me say good morning once again to Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Wade. How are you today?
I'm doing well, doing well.
Great. Thank you for having us again. We're excited to be interviewing another guest this week. We've got J.B. Hanley, the author of a new book called How to End the Autism Epidemic. J.B. Hanley is a parent of a child who has autism. J.B.'s not a doctor, but J.B., I would say, probably knows more than any doctor I've met in regards to autism and vaccine injuries in general. So, J.B., welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've got an hour, but I feel like we might need three or four to get through even half of what you've talked about in this book. So I really encourage all the listeners to get the book. We'll hit the highlights for sure. But it's just such a going to be a great resource, I know, for all of my patients. I have a number of parents who end up at our clinic because, for various reasons, but a number of them because their pediatricians have kicked them out of their practice. Because they've questioned the routine vaccine schedule that the CDC produces. And in our clinic, we're all about education. We want informed, true informed consent for all our patients. So we've traditionally had to send them here and there and everywhere to various books and resources and websites to gather information about the pros and cons of different vaccines and the potential risk and injuries. But your book pretty much covers it all, so it will definitely be the go-to resource for our patients. So thank you for writing that book.
I'm obviously thrilled to hear that, so thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And I just want to give people a little preview in case we don't get to all this, because I almost don't know where to start. You cover so many amazing things. Even going back to the historical data that shows 90% reduction in childhood infectious disease mortality by 1940, which is prior to vaccines. A lot of people are under the misconception that vaccines cured the world of all these infectious diseases when it turns out there are other factors involved, all the way to showing evidence that measles and chickenpox decrease certain disease risk later in life. If you acquired measles naturally, you decrease your rates of certain cancers. You go over the ingredients that are in a vaccine, 30 different ingredients, one of which has been tested in one study, you point out, and that was aluminum, but unfortunately that study wasn't even a great study. It was not the same aluminum. They tested it orally, not as an injection. They tested it in adults, not kids. You go into the AAP, the American Association of Pediatrics, and you remind everybody it's a trade union for pediatricians, basically, and that their website states it's safe to give all these multiple vaccines at one time, but then you point to a study that shows the exact opposite. I mean, you just cover such a breadth, wide range of topics that give parents really a whole new understanding of what they're getting into if they're going to choose to vaccinate their children, which obviously it's a choice that some people are going to choose, but it needs to be an informed choice. So that's the point of the show today. I think that's the point of JB's book, is to fully inform everybody, because I don't want to speak for you, JB, but I think you probably didn't feel fully informed when you brought your newborn baby to the pediatrician. So I'm going to be quiet now and really let you just take it away, and I think would be obviously appropriate to talk about your experience and kind of what set you on this track that ended up in this book. So share with the audience kind of what got you even looking at this whole autism vaccine debate.
Absolutely. And first of all, it's very gratifying for me to talk to somebody who's obviously read my book from cover to cover. And frankly, your reaction of feeling a little bit overwhelmed by all the data and all the information is exactly the reaction that I hope for when people read my book. I would say that it's really not a memoir, right? Some people think when a parent writes a book about autism, it's going to be a memoir. It's not a memoir. There's a little bit on my own journey, but it's really about the science and the facts. And I think that's what parents care the most about. My wife and I had as mainstream a journey, if you will, as anybody could have. And by that I mean when my middle son was born in 2002, we were 100% mainstream people. And what that meant was that we were going to effectively cede control of the health of our baby to our local pediatrician. And at the time, I thought that was the most prudent way to ensure that my baby would be safe, and as did my wife, which was, of course, our singular goal, to have a safe, healthy, happy child. I had actually been a military brat, and so I remembered getting vaccines, and I couldn't remember any negative reactions, and I figured that vaccines were something every baby should get. And so when the pediatrician went about the plan of vaccinating my son on the CDC's recommended schedule, it didn't even cross my mind to be concerned about that. Frankly, in 2002, there was very little noise out there about the vaccine-autism connection, nowhere near the kind of drama and headlines that have happened since that time. So we were taking our son to the pediatrician, and as you well know, there's a 2-month appointment, a 4-month appointment, a 6-month appointment, and a 12-month appointment for a child to get vaccinations. On many of those appointments, the child is getting 5 or 6 vaccines. And after each appointment, my son got progressively sicker. After the 2-month appointment, he developed eczema. He lost the ability to sleep through the night. In fact, he couldn't sleep for more than 10 minutes at a time. You can imagine what that did to our family. And, you know, night after night after night, his belly became distended, meaning bloated. He developed dark circles under his eyes, and he clearly became allergic to a number of foods. He started getting ear infections, which, of course, our pediatrician gave him antibiotics for, to the point where in the first 2 years of his life, he ended up with more than a dozen rounds of antibiotics. And we watched him getting progressively sicker. Our son's health became the center concern of our life. And as he rounded that 12-month birthday, the neurological problems started to kick in. So it went from just being a physical health problem to a mental health problem, too. My son lost his words. He started behaving unusually. He stopped playing with things in normal manners. He began running along walls. It started to feel like he wasn't even aware of our comings and goings. And, you know, needless to say, we were deeply, deeply concerned. And I speak about in the book that there was a fork in the road that occurred just a little bit before my son's second birthday, where we finally had gathered up enough data and information to believe that autism was a real possibility. And, yet, you know, in most states, this was true in California where we lived at the time. I now live in Oregon, but we lived in California at the time. There's a gap between when you want to get a child diagnosed and when you can get in for an appointment. And so we finally got in to see one of the leading diagnosticians in the world at the University of California, San Francisco. And at the same time, we were learning about alternative therapies for autism and ways to treat these children. And so we also were visiting what they called at the time a DAM doctor, to feed autism now, down in Pleasanton, California. So I make the point in the book that we're meeting with these two highly pedigreed physicians, both MDs, both went to medical school. Ironically, they were both psychiatrists. And the one at UCSF, who was very mainstream, told us that our son might be institutionalized, that this was a genetic ailment, and we could do about it. You know, good luck, get some educational therapy. It's going to be a long road. Okay, that was her guidance. At the same time, we were meeting with a DAM doctor. Her name is Lynn Milkey. She practices in Pleasanton, California. And Dr. Milkey's son also had autism, and she felt strongly that his autism had come from his vaccines. And she was treating children in her clinic for vaccine injury, which is called autism. So here we are getting two completely different views of the world, not 30 miles apart from each other. And when we ran the things we were learning about autism by the diagnostician at UCSF, she told us that things like biomedical intervention and autism recovery were really just placebos for parents, that there was nothing to that stuff, and certainly vaccines weren't at play at all. And yet Dr. Milkey down in Pleasanton gave us the exact opposite information. And we felt like we were at a fork in the road for our son's life and really for our own lives in many ways, because if you haven't been through this, I will tell you that it shakes your entire foundation and your entire trust, if you will, in humanity in many ways. And it did for us, that what we were being told was so opposite from what was actually happening. And when we opened the door to Dr. Milkey and to the reality of what had been done to our son, it made us very angry. It made us very motivated. And since that day, we've struck a balance, my wife and I both, between advocacy to try to share with other parents what happened to us so it won't happen to them, and a focus on our son to try to recover him, to try to get him back from what I genuinely believe has nothing to do with genetics, but is a clear and unequivocal vaccine injury. And so that's where our journey started. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about in my book was I still feel guilty today. I didn't do the proper research before the first vaccine. I didn't understand that the vaccine schedule had ballooned from three licensed vaccines in the mid-1980s, which, by the way, not only were there only three licensed vaccines in the mid-1980s versus the 11 today that we have, but the vaccination rates in the mid-1980s when I was a sophomore in high school were between 50 and 60% for each of the three vaccines, which were DTP, MMR, and polio. Today, we have 11 licensed vaccines with vaccination rates in excess of 90%. Ironically, children today are dramatically less healthy than children were in the mid-1980s. And so the fair question would be, why? What has happened? What has changed, right? Why are there peanut-free tables? Why are there EpiPens in schools? Why do 54% of children have a chronic illness? Why do upwards of 25% of children end up in special education? What has happened to make this generation of children so unhealthy? And I believe the evidence is clear through published science that vaccines are the primary trigger chronic illness epidemic, that we are effectively trading a minor reduction in certain acute illnesses that vaccines prevent, and we're trading that for an explosion in lifelong chronic illnesses, not just physical ones, but neurological ones as well. And I think that's a really heavy concept for somebody to take on for the first time. It's almost impossible to believe, frankly, that something on that scale could be done to the population by the medical community. And I think one of the reasons to write my book is to try to take people through that step by step and to use analogies like tobacco and lung cancer and DDT and lead paint and on and on the list goes of other examples where there was a massive scale of damage done to the human population by people who were ostensibly trying to make people either more healthy or do other good things where they ended up making horrible, horrible mistakes. And I think that's what we are now dealing with. And we now have not just 54% of children with a chronic illness. We have 1 in 36 children with autism, a devastating lifelong disability. And I wrote the book because I genuinely believe something radical needs to be done. It's not tenable to have this many children this sick.
Well, I agree 100%. And I want to say, I mean, you mentioned guilt, but you were just being a good dad. I mean, as far as you knew at the time, you were doing the thing to protect and provide that safe and healthy environment. So, I mean, I would say on behalf of my profession, I'll apologize, if no doctor has apologized to you, for the failure of our profession to give you the true informed consent that you deserved and every parent deserves. So please accept that apology. And that's why we do what we do now, to truly inform not only our patients but the general public. Because as you said, that vaccination, that's a medical procedure, you said in your book. Any medical procedure, whether you're going to go have a knee replacement, a hip replacement, have your tonsils out, or have a bypass surgery or whatever, the doctor is supposed to and required to give informed consent, tell you the pros, tell you the cons, and then let the patient decide if the pros outweigh the cons and if they really want to do that. And I think that's obviously the point of your book too, but if that were done properly with you, you know, then you may have made a different choice, including still doing the vaccine, but maybe just delay or maybe do a screening like you talk about in the book. There are techniques to potentially reduce the risk of an injury. And that's what we all want. We want healthy, safe kids. So,
you know, one of the, first of all, I appreciate your comments and I appreciate the apology. And I certainly know on a rational level that my intentions were pure, as 99.999% of parents' intentions are pure. They want their baby to be healthy. At the same time, I personally feel the ultimate responsibility for looking out for my children. And so I feel like I let my son down. And I'm okay with that perpetual guilt, and I talk about in the book, it fueled the book, and it fuels my focus on recovery, because the only thing that really takes the sting out of what happened to my son is his improvement. And I'm okay with that trait. I don't need absolution today. I'm a walking human being. I'm healthy. I have a happy family. It's my son who's had his life rock. I get to experience the joys of a mainstream life, if you will. I've gotten married. I went to college. I played sports. I had a successful business career. I have two neurotypical children who I've watched develop normally, and I've seen them enjoy their lives. And so my life is rich and fulfilled, and what I'm really fighting for is what got stolen from my son. And with each day that he gets better, you know, my guilt is reduced through that. And I'm, again, I'm okay with that trait. I'm a grown man, and I'm a big boy, and I can handle it. And I'm looking forward to my son's life as it continues to get better and better. His quality of life from the day we stepped off the vaccine path and onto the biomedical recovery path, his life has gotten better and better. He has joy. He has love. He's getting closer and closer to normal, and so that path continues for us. And so in that way, guilt has been a fuel, if you will, to make up for what I didn't do early on. And, you know, one of the comments I want to make to you as a medical professional, because I know that you understand this, most pediatricians, if not all, are not trained in how to recognize vaccine injury.
Yeah.
It's insidious, yeah. Right? You don't, your arm doesn't fall off after a vaccine. It's actually a complex process that happens. And worse, we now know through published biological science, there's often a latency period between when the vaccine is injected and when the side effects manifest. That latency period can be up to 4 or 5 years, for goodness sakes. And so how is a parent supposed to draw the hepatitis B vaccine that their baby got when they were 2 months old and the dyslexia they're exhibiting at age six?
Right.
It's nearly impossible. But even the more obvious vaccine injuries for somebody who knows, most pediatricians miss. And so the crime for me is that when my son was exhibiting clear, skull negative symptoms immediately following vaccine appointments, my pediatrician did not even have the training or the knowledge to recognize the connection and to step back and say, you know what, we need to take a break from this child. It's on the border of being negligent, but I do recognize that, you know, my pediatrician and most others were never trained in these things. And that's part of how this epidemic can hide in plain sight. We're not drawing the connections because the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, is denying most of them. And the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, who represents pediatricians, is also denying most of them. And so the pediatricians I know who have awoken what's going on, and there's a great one right here in Portland named Paul Thomas, who's even written books about this topic, they had to go do their own research.
Yeah.
And now they recognize what's going on. I think my pediatrician, who happens to be Paul Thomas, this published author, his journey is fascinating because what he will say is that in the late 1990s, the health of his pediatric population started to turn for the worst. And, of course, he knew, because he was administering the vaccines, that the one thing that had changed materially was the number of shots that he was giving the kids. And so, using his own brain, he started to apply deductive reasoning that there may be something going on here between this increase in the number of shots I'm giving to children and the fact that I'm seeing some of them fall off a cliff and many more of them develop autoimmune conditions. And so he went on his own journey, and as he amended the vaccine schedule, reduced the total number, delayed some, pulled others, he started to see the health of his patient population here in Portland return. And so I think the data from open-minded pediatricians like Dr. Paul Thomas are really, really important and really, really compelling, not only for parents, but for other medical professionals to wake up, listen to people who are stepping outside of the current mainstream mantras and seeing their patient populations improve.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, and again, I'll speak up for all the physicians, pediatricians, family practitioners, we're not trained in how to recognize a vaccine injury, and really we aren't trained much about vaccinations in general. All that I can recall, which it's been, you know, 15 years since I was in med school, but I'm pretty sure all I was really trained in was the schedule. I remember that CDC printed off schedule, and basically, here's the schedule, memorize it, and be sure it's implemented in all your kids in your clinic. But as far as how are the vaccines made, how do they work, all these adjuvants, what are all the ingredients, what do those do? I mean, I knew the word adjuvant. I knew they put the stuff in there to enhance the immune response, but it was a very kind of superficial understanding, no depth at all. And for sure didn't go into vaccine injury. In fact, I can admit that I didn't even know there was a vaccine compensation program and a reportable, way to report a vaccine injury. And you talk about in your book a Harvard study that showed only 1% or maybe less than 1% of vaccine injuries are reported. And honestly, I didn't even know in my family practice life prior to what I do now that I sure didn't know to look for it, didn't know to report it. So that study from Harvard, I could see why the results were so bad.
Well, to clarify for parents who may be new to this particular topic, there was a law passed in 1986. It indemnified vaccine makers from liability, which means that if you're injured by a vaccine, you don't sue a vaccine maker. You sue the United States government through something called the Court of Special Claims, which we call Vaccine Court. The Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, the acronym is VICP, you can look up for yourself and see that they've paid $3.8 billion in vaccine injury to American citizens since the court was up and running beginning in 1989. For most people, it's a shock to know that vaccines can even cause injury, much less that the government's well aware of it and actually has a program to compensate people. And then what you're mentioning is there's a post-marketing surveillance system known as the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, where people are encouraged to basically type in vaccine injuries that they see in their own medical practices. And the purpose of that is to try to determine if there's like a hot lot or a big issue that comes about. They hope that the data through the modern system will provide that. But as the Harvard study pointed out, less than 1% of vaccine injuries are actually reported. And what's interesting about the Harvard Pilgrim study that you mentioned that I talked about in my book, basically the Centers for Disease Control was interested in trying to systematize the recognition of vaccine injury. And what that means is that if a patient presents with a handful of symptoms the way my son did, ideally, a bell would go off to say, oh, that sounds like a vaccine injury. And so they basically used computers to systematize the reporting of vaccine injuries in a small medical practice to see if this was something that they could then roll out nationally. Well, in the Harvard Pilgrim study, what they found was that more than 2% of people vaccinated exhibited some kind of vaccine injury. That's not a number that is acceptable for the Centers for Disease Control, meaning that 2% is way too high an injury rate. And so since they were getting such a high injury rate, the CDC just shut the whole program down. So we still have the report, but even the study authors were puzzled because they said that the CDC basically stopped communicating with them and kind of moved on. It's like if we put too big a microscope on vaccine injury, we're going to learn more about it than we want to know, rather not know, so let's just shut the whole thing down. It's pretty amazing when you read the details.
Yeah. Well, I find that vaccine court, some of the details you talk about in the book, in particular the whole situation with Dr. Zimmerman, Dr. Kelly, who are physicians, well-respected physicians in the vaccine world, were called on to be expert witnesses for the vaccine court, basically to judge whether a vaccine caused an injury, and oftentimes they would be quoted to say, no, the vaccine was not the culprit in these various injuries. So these two experts for the vaccine court ended up actually flipping, or were going to flip, and actually say, no, a vaccine did cause autism in the daughter of one of their fellow physicians, a physician in training, or a fellow, actually, like a medical resident who's in training. That was just a fascinating story about Hannah. Fascinating, yeah. in a bad way, really. The most egregious thing, and you'll need to explain this better than me, because basically I look at this, is there are 5,000 families on the line, there are 5,500 families on the line, and the court said, we can't handle that many cases, so we're going to pick three. And whatever we end up determining for these three, we're going to have that stand for the entire 55. Could you explain that more clearly?
I think that this is like, you know, overwhelming for most parents to even understand what's actually gone on somewhat behind the scenes. So, first of all, we have a vaccine court, okay? It's important for people to understand the purpose of the vaccine court is to maintain the vaccine program. And that's confusing because you'd think that a court set up to adjudicate injuries from vaccines, that the purpose of the court would be to protect people, but it's not. It's there to maintain the vaccine program. When the vaccine court was formed based on the 1986 law, what's very interesting when you go back and look at the history, the word autism is nowhere to be seen. Nowhere to be seen in any explanations for why the court was needed. Basically, the old DTP vaccine was causing brain damage in a lot of children. Parents were starting to sue vaccine makers, and the vaccine makers came to Congress and said, if we don't get some help here, we're all going to go out of business. So that's why the 1986 law was passed. Okay, so fast forward to the late 1990s, all of a sudden the autism claims are going through the roof because what had happened was the number of vaccines had exploded, and before you knew it, many parents were going through the same experience that my wife and I went through.
And I just want to interject, JP, real quick, that at that moment in time when that vaccine court was established and they indemnified the vaccine company so you couldn't sue a vaccine company, pre that law, there were, what, three vaccines? And post that...
three licensed vaccine, today 11.
And then, so right at that point, it exploded, which that's a whole other discussion about the pharmaceutical companies deciding to put so much of their resource into vaccines. There's a big profit margin. There's and obviously, they can't be sued, so there's no liability concerns there.
We went from a $300 million business to a $60 billion business. I think it's hard for people to recognize the growth that has gone on.
Yeah.
So that's $60 billion in vaccine revenues versus $300 million before the 1986 law. You take away the company's need to handle their own liability, and that's what happens. You remove the free market principles from the whole equation.
Yeah.
So thousands of parents out of the blue in the late 90s and early 2000s began to file claims in vaccine court. And the vaccine court, they effectively can create a class action dynamic. They call it an omnibus, okay? So it just means class action. So they created an omnibus autism proceeding because, frankly, the court was overwhelmed with claims. And because they had 5,500 claims, and because they simply didn't have the manpower to adjudicate 5,500 claims, they said, look, they're all basically claiming the same basic thing, so we'll get somewhere between 3 and 6 test cases. And if any of the test cases show causation between the vaccine and autism, everybody in the 5,500 will get compensation, right? So it was basically a class action style settlement within a very complex vaccine court. They get ready, the lawyers who are working for the 5,500 parents, they are looking through all the different cases to find sort of the optimal cases. One of the cases they find that is optimal is a young girl named Hannah Poling. And part of what makes Hannah's case optimal is that her father, John, was working at the Kennedy Krieger Institute, the leading autism institute in the world. It's part of Johns Hopkins University. And he was a neurologist. And so he did all the tests, documented everything for what happened to his daughter when she progressed into autism after her vaccines. The other thing that Mr. Poling did, or Dr. Poling rather, did unwittingly was he educated his colleagues on what had happened to his daughter. And it just so happened that the head of Kennedy Krieger, whose name is Andrew Zimmerman, had historically been an expert witness for the government in vaccine court, saying vaccines don't cause autism. Hannah changed his mind. He realized that a certain vulnerable subset of children, if presented with vaccines at the wrong time, could indeed descend into autism. And when he let the vaccine court know that he had changed his mind based on the experience of Hannah, they dismissed him from vaccine court. And worse, they settled Anna's case before she could be one of the test cases in the autism omnibus. It's a very underhanded move. The vaccine court always retains the right to settle any case. So as the plaintiff side was presenting Hannah as one of their test cases who could clearly and unequivocally show that vaccines cause autism, settled for $20 million, Anna's case, and buried it. So I explained that in detail, and it is a confusing story. But I think what parents should understand is that Dr. Zimmerman, arguably the leading mainstream autism clinician in the world, has continued to maintain, for anybody who asks him, that vaccines can in fact cause autism. And it just so happened that there was a case in Tennessee just in the last year where a parent was suing their pediatrician for negligence, basically saying that their pediatrician did what I believe my pediatrician did. They continued to vaccinate his child after his child had clearly exhibited symptoms of vaccine injury. And so, therefore, he was accusing his pediatrician of being negligent. And he brought in Dr. Zimmerman as an expert witness. And Dr. Zimmerman provided a deposition, meaning that he testified under oath. And his deposition I recount in my book in detail in what the most mainstream and arguably pedigreed autism clinician in the world says is that certain vulnerable children, where he defines vulnerability as having a mitochondrial disorder, which basically means low cellular energy, for a child with a vulnerability, getting vaccines at the wrong time can trip them into autism. And as I say in my book, in the chapter where I write about Dr. Zimmerman's testimony, I'm like, this should be my only chapter.
Yeah.
It's no longer a debate. You have the most mainstream clinician in the world working at Johns Hopkins in the Kennedy Krieger Institute saying exactly what parents have been saying for decades. And arguably, as importantly, the other thing that Dr. Zimmerman is saying very, very clearly is that children need to be screened before their first vaccine. We actually know some of the key points of vulnerability that would make a child react badly to a vaccine. Those children should be removed forever from the vaccination pool. And the fact that we aren't employing that screening, that we aren't taking Dr. Zimmerman's words to heart, that we aren't having a public conversation about this is a shame. And children are literally being injured every day because of our unwillingness to basically face the elephant in the room. And I know, you know, you were already open when you read my book, but I really believe that anybody but the most closed-up person, if they read my book from start to finish, they will recognize that we have a serious, serious problem, that this debate is wide open, that the evidence is growing and compelling for the connection, and that we as a society, we need to do something about this. There are too many children being injured. And I hope, I don't know Dr. Zimmerman personally, I hope at some point he chooses to speak up more publicly. I know that the amount of ridicule and the attempts to sort of ruin his career will begin, but at some point, you know, grown-ups need to step up and do the right thing. So I hope Dr. Zimmerman will become one of them. And I think that anybody who reads that chapter in my book, it will absolutely blow your mind. I want to add one other little detail. After the Hannah Poling case was settled and then the autism omnibus proceeding ended, and of course they found that vaccines didn't cause autism because they buried Dr. Zimmerman's testimony, they settled Hannah Poling's case. They basically did everything they could because if the court is there to protect the vaccine program, admitting that vaccines cause autism would arguably destroy the vaccine program. You can argue about whether that would really happen or not, but I think that's what they believed, and so they went out of their way. You got to remember, there's no jury in vaccine court. There's simply a single judge who can make the entire decision. It's crazy. It's not a real court. Anyway, after after that whole thing happened, a number of parents, including a law professor at NYU named Mary Hollins, they decided to look into the vaccine court's history and see if other children had received compensation who had autism. And what they found was that parents had been going to vaccine court for well over 10 years. They had a child with autism, but they didn't use the word autism in their filing, and they were receiving compensation for brain damage or whatever else it might be. They found, and by the way, these records are typically sealed, and they could still find 83 cases of children who'd gone through vaccine court, who had used words like brain injury rather than autism, who'd gotten compensated and who had autism. And so the court's actually been compensating children there for years.
Yeah.
Drop the A word into the mix, everything changes.
Yeah, that's just so, I can't imagine being one of those 5,500 families where the one.
You know, I've heard from, I wasn't one, my wife and I did not. Because, you know, you actually can only file within 3 years of the date of injury. So if it takes you more than 3 years to figure out what happened to your kid, and I talked about, you know, latency period and everything, you're out of luck. But anyway, I've heard from dozens of parents who are in that 5,500 group who've read my book, and they're outraged.
Yeah. Well, I would be too. Somewhere in your book, you quote $2.4 million is the average, and I'd say that's probably on the lower side, but the average lifetime cost of taking care of a kiddo with autism. And, I mean, you can't even put a dollar amount on it. The life that's robbed and all the future potential from that life, the strain on the marriage, the strain on the family, just all of it, you can't put a price tag on it, but it's devastating to those families that weren't compensated.
registered 70% of families with children with autism end up in divorce. I don't know if that number is real, but I believe it.
Yeah.
It is devastating. Of course, I know I'm speaking for every parent of a child with autism. I'd give every penny I ever had, and every future penny, to have a time machine to go back and do things the right way with my son.
Yep. Well, we got to take a quick break at the bottom of the hour here, and when we come back, we're going to dive more into the science, because that's another part of the book. JB really goes into not only all the really awfulness of the vaccine court, I would say, but and a lot of the conflicts of interest and all kinds of stuff, but there's the science. And so when we come back from the break, we'll go through that science of how could a vaccine cause autism. So stick with us. We'll be right back. A lot of the conflicts of interest and all kinds of stuff, but there's the science. And so when we come back from the break, we'll go through that science of how could a vaccine cause autism. So stick with us. Those are initials, J period, B period, Handley, H-A-N-D-L-E-Y. Okay.
I want to mention one thing about the book. I have like a 12-person promotional team that's helped me. I have a great publisher named Chelsea Green. 12-person mm-hmm. promotional team working every angle in the media to try to get the book out there. The mainstream media will not touch this book. We still hit the top 40 on Amazon. We still made the public bestseller list. The first printing of the book has sold out completely at this point, and yet not a single mention of my book in any mainstream media source at all. That is how locked down the pharmaceutical industry has our mainstream media today, and it's really sad. It's really true.
It is really sad, and you touch on that too in the book, specifically that CBS reporter Cheryl Atkinson, who kind of got onto this thing and shows how big pharma gets in the advertising budget of all the mainstream media, and she likened it to the big tobacco, and basically it's the big tobacco thing all over again. I mean, people forget, unless you're alive in the 40s or whenever these commercials came out, doctors promoting, you know, Camel, I think, was the brand. The one doctors most recommend is Camel. And I mean, doctors went from advertising this stuff, but it took like 50 years from when the science started showing cigarette smoking could cause cancer. You know, 50 years, and now, of course, we all know there was a lot of cover-up, there was a lot of collusion, there was a lot of conflict of interest, and a lot of money changing hands, but eventually the truth came out, and it appears to be the exact same thing going on here. And that's another great part of the book. I'm telling y'all, you got to get the book. I'm glad it's in that top 40. Imagine if people would just speak the truth in the mainstream media on this. But I want to go through, JB, because, I mean, this was the first time I'd seen this. And I'm an integrative physician who tries to stay well-informed, but I had not seen it laid out step by step by step. So clearly in Chapter 5, where you just go through the studies, the published medical studies, many of which are from outside of the United States, by the way, which is an interesting side note. But it's an 11-step, boom, 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 boom. Here's what happens. Here's how an injection a vaccine injection could cause this damage in the brain. So could you kind of summarize and go through some of that for the listeners?
Absolutely. And let me take a big step back, because it's very confusing for parents who hear the mantra over and over again that the science is settled, right? Mm-hmm. This is a mantra that the mainstream has adopted. The science is settled on the relationship between vaccines and autism. And the science that they point to, I debunk, if you will, or dismantle in my book. And that science is all what we call epidemiology, right? Epidemiology is numbers on a spreadsheet, looking at medical records, comparing children, et cetera. And I think it's easiest to use the tobacco analogy, because most people get it. If you compare a smoker smoking 2 packs a day to a smoker smoking 1 pack a day, and there's no difference in lung cancer rates, that doesn't mean that cigarettes don't cause lung cancer, right? But that's exactly the methodology that was used in a number of these vaccine studies using epidemiology, where they've only looked at one vaccine ingredient, thimerosal, which is a form of mercury, and one actual vaccine, the MMR vaccine. Those are the only two they've ever studied for their relationship to autism. But remember, there's 11 vaccines on the schedule, and there are 30, 40, 50 ingredients, depending on which vaccine you're talking about. And so they did the most superficial of analysis. In many cases, they gamed it to do this 2-pack-a-day versus 1-pack-a-day business. and then they reached conclusions that meant nothing, and then they claim the debate's over. And I really do go through this in detail in my book. I think anybody by the end of that chapter will recognize what I'm saying to be true.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we have an entirely different kind of science. It's called biological science, and biological science means that some kind of mammal received the product, it got tested on them, and then they evaluated their body and their brains afterwards to see what happened. It's typically a mouse or a monkey or something else. The biological science showing how a vaccine can cause injury is damning. It's been replicated. There are many studies out there. So let's take a step back. What we now know to be a fact is that something known as an immune activation event, if it happens at the wrong time, can trigger autism. And let me explain. The brain has its own immune system. If the immune system in the brain has to react to a substance, it will often create inflammation, an immune activation event. The immune system in the brain will release what we call cytokines to try to take care of whatever is causing the immune system to react. And there's an immune activation event that takes place in the brain. This can happen from a cold or an illness or something else. But if an immune activation event in a severe manner happens at the wrong time during critical phases of brain development, autism can come from that. Okay, so this was a theory that was proven out by a researcher at Caltech named Paul Patterson, where he basically showed in a very famous paper that wasn't published until 2006, which in scientific terms is still very recent, showing how an immune activation event while a baby's inside the mom, so a maternal immune activation event, can cause either autism or schizophrenia. So Dr. Patterson had this theory. It was borne out through mice models where they could show that immune activation events at the wrong time triggered.
Vitamins Plus is a full-line health food store located inside Drug Emporium on the corner of 80s.
We've begun to learn more and more about immune activation events and how they happen. There was a Canadian researcher named Christopher Shaw. He started to look at a specific vaccine ingredient, aluminum, and its potentially negative effects on the brain as well. And what Dr. Shaw learned was that aluminum was very, very toxic to brain cells and to the nervous system. And then scientists started to piece things together. Well, can the aluminum in a vaccine cause an immune activation event? So, you know, you go and you give the aluminum to a mouse, and we have all these biomarkers, right? Markers that we know now in the brains that are proof of it, that an immune activation event happened. These biomarkers started to prove that, in fact, aluminum can cause an immune activation event. Well, can the aluminum from vaccines do that? Yes, it can. And so I take you through all 11 steps that kind of have gotten us to this point. And then the kicker, one that really kind of sealed the deal, a professor out of England showed by looking at the brains of actual people who had passed away, looking at the brains of people with autism, that the aluminum levels in these people were extremely high, extraordinarily high, far higher than an average person. And more importantly, we now understand kind of exactly how it takes place. I'm going to walk you through this. The vaccine is injected subcutaneously, meaning under the skin, into the muscle. The immune system immediately reacts because the aluminum that's in a vaccine is man-made. It's not ionic aluminum out of the ground. It's man-made aluminum, which is actually in something called a nanoparticulate form. That form of aluminum is not recognized by the body. So the immune system gets extremely agitated and extremely concerned when it comes across it. Something called a macrophage, which is kind of like the garbage can of your immune system, immediately reacts to the injected vaccine. It grabs the aluminum, and it doesn't know what to do with it. It doesn't know how to process it. The macrophage moves through the body, and enough of it will ultimately circulate into the brain where it gets stuck. When the aluminum hits the brain, it triggers an immune activation event, but not a temporary immune activation event, but a permanent immune activation event. Okay? So they describe that people with autism they effectively have brains that are kind of a permanent state of inflammation, and they've been able to discover this by actually looking at the brains of people with autism after they passed away. So there's an ongoing immune activation event. That ongoing immune activation event triggers a change in brain development. Okay, so we now kind of understand how this whole process takes place. It's important to recognize aluminum is in the majority of childhood vaccinations, and the reason it's there is to antagonize the immune system, to wake up the immune system. And when the immune system wakes up, it has a little antigen of whatever disease it's trying to protect you against. And the immune system recognizes that as well and hopefully develops antibodies that will allow your body to then fight that particular disease. So the aluminum is there for a reason. What we didn't know when we developed vaccines 70 years ago is that if that aluminum gets into the brain, it can do severe damage. And what the research out of England showed when it looked at the actual brains of people with autism and measured them for aluminum levels is not only that the aluminum levels were very high, but it was the location of the aluminum that was very distinct. It was in the macrophage part of the brain rather than other parts of the brain, which as Professor Chris actually out of Keele University who did this research explained, it's like a Trojan horse brings the aluminum into the brain. Okay, so we have this very clear, documented step-by-step process for injected vaccine, move through the body, into the brain, triggers immune activation event, and if it happens at the wrong time, the result is autism. I'd say it's bordering on scientific fact. What's really interesting is there was actually a study done within 2018 published out of China, and it was the first time that someone had actually done like a full vaccine and a full placebo into mice. So they took the hepatitis B vaccine, which is given to American babies either on day one of life or at 2 months of life for the first time, and they inject Hep B into some mice. They injected aluminum into others, and they injected saline placebo into a third, and then they compared those two groups. And what they found in no uncertain terms was that the hepatitis B vaccine caused severe brain damage, and that it triggered the production of the biomarkers that we now know are correlated to autism. So not to bore you with too much detail, but in cytokines, the immune system of the brain releases cytokines during an inflammatory response. One of the biggest cytokines, most important cytokines, is called IL-6. And IL-6, if you have high IL-6 in the brain, that's a classic biomarker for autism. And what the Chinese researchers discovered is that the hepatitis B vaccine in the mice triggered high IL-6. And what's interesting, by the way, China is not controlled by pharmaceutical interests. The study I'm referring to was actually funded by the Chinese government because the Chinese are having an autism problem, and they're trying to figure out why. And they made the decision 15, 20 years ago to start to adapt and adopt the Western-style vaccination schedule, and guess what? They've had an explosion in autism. And so I don't talk about this too much in my book, but I really do believe that the autism epidemic will end in another country first. I think that we are so controlled here by the pharmaceutical industry that ironically, because we always rail on China being less free and all, you know, we always have these negative views of China, even as their economy, you know, kicks our butt, even as, you know, like, their cities are growing and they're doing great as a society. We always have these negative views of China, but I really believe that a different country with less influence from the pharmaceutical industry will probably drive the end of the autism epidemic because they're taking real clear looks at what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, and that would be, in one way, really great, and another way, really sad.
It is sad, and pharma has done a wonderful job of co-opting the media, right? We're one of two countries in the world where pharmaceutical companies can advertise on television, yeah. Right? So that has a huge impact, right? We've got the vaccine court, so they're out of the court system altogether, and then they do a wonderful job supporting legislators to the point where you almost can't run for national office without pharmaceutical support, and so they're really doing a great job, if you will, of shutting down this debate.
Yeah, and I can't pass up this hepatitis, just a quick comment on that, which obviously you go into in your book, but this hepatitis vaccine is given typically a day of life one, unless a parent refuses it, and the blood-brain barrier isn't even developed in a baby until day of life eight, so you're getting this whopping dose of aluminum, which I believe it was Paul Thompson, the pediatrician in Portland I was listening to one day, did the calculation on that, what the EPA even recommends as a safe level of aluminum for an adult was surpassed in this one injection. But more importantly is the hepatitis. Pregnant moms today in America are screened for hepatitis when they're pregnant. So you know who has it or who doesn't. And if they don't, why do you even need to give the shot? Because the only way to get hepatitis is IV drug abuse or sexual intercourse typically. And these antibodies that this vaccine induces at day of life one wear off by 10 or 15 years old. So by the time a kid may want to experiment with intercourse and IV drugs at 18 years old, the antibodies are gone anyway. So we're putting all this aluminum in. It's craziness.
It's one of the most crazy. I think anybody who treats vaccine like a medical procedure and therefore does the appropriate research, would be one of the first to fall off their want list, if you will, for vaccines. It doesn't make any rational sense. First of all, hepatitis B is a devastating illness. I would never want my baby to have it. And if a mom is Hep B positive, I would give the baby the hepatitis B vaccine.
Agreed.
But as you say, all moms are screened for it. And so if you're screened ahead of time, I say in complete confidence, there's no reason to give that to a baby.
Yeah, 100% agree. So the biological science you laid out in great detail in the book, and it was awesome. You mentioned epidemiological science. I do just want to give you an opportunity to comment on that, because epidemiological science appears to me to be much more manipulatable, if that's a word, or you can just throw away the data. We have interviewed on this program before Bill Thompson with the CDC whistleblower case from the Atlanta study, CDC study. We've interviewed Andy Wakefield on here, so our listeners are somewhat familiar with how data can be thrown in a trash can, but also manipulated. And one doctor you mentioned, a CDC doctor out of Utah, was watching some of this epidemiological data, looking at trends, and basically her data was ignored or manipulated. So speak to CDC can be compromised or ignored or manipulated.
Well, one of the crazy things that we haven't talked about too much is that there are people out there who want to deny that we even have an autism epidemic.
Yeah.
They want to claim that it's better diagnosis and expanded criteria, and we're just recognizing the children now, which is, if you're my age, I'm almost 50, is insane. That's completely insane. I mean, I grew up in the United States in the 70s and 80s, and I never saw a kid with autism once. And now my children know plenty of children with autism. And I go through in great detail in my book all the published science on what we call prevalence that shows clearly that the prevalence of autism has risen dramatically. The researcher who you are referring to out of Utah is Judith Kinborough Zimmerman. And Dr. Zimmerman was part of the CDC's network to count autism cases. Her job was actually to support what they call the ADDM network, where they actually do the prevalence studies. And what Dr. Zimmerman has asserted, clearly and unequivocally, and continues to assert to this day, is that the CDC exercised pressure on the Utah numbers to keep the prevalence rate down. That they literally were worried that it kept getting worse, and the worse it gets, the more an environmental agent has to be behind it. And in one of the craziest fox in the henhouse dynamics ever, the Centers for Disease Control is not only in charge of implementing the vaccination program, they're in charge of counting the autism cases.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
So
unbelievable.
He actually sued and won a whistleblower lawsuit against the CDC and against the University of Utah because she felt that her data was being suppressed.
Yeah.
And what's amazing, I didn't write about it in my book because it happened after the fact, but another ADM network researcher out of New Jersey, whose name is Walter Zaharandi out of Rutgers, he basically is saying the same thing. I can't believe how bad the numbers have gotten. I can't believe there's not more press about it. Where is the national outrage and concern about what's going on, because the numbers continue to skyrocket? And the CDC has done a great job of basically implying that the prevalence is up, but we don't know if the actual number of people is up. And they're just creating this doubt out there, because to acknowledge that indeed it's gone from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 36 means there has to be an explanation for that, and that explanation has to be environmental.
Yep.
And we all know what all the parents are saying, like me. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that the CDC would be interested in keeping that story at bay for as long as possible.
Right.
People probably don't appreciate that. The best thing that can happen to you if you work at the CDC is that you get picked off by pharma and go work for pharma.
Yep.
And so there's a revolving door between that agency and the pharmaceutical industry. And so if you're working at CDC, you probably don't want to acknowledge that vaccines are causing the autism epidemic, because your odds of getting a job in pharma fall quite precipitously after that happens. And so the CDC in many ways is what we call a captured agency, where the industry has taken over the decision making there because of the financial incentives of people who work at CDC to ultimately work at pharma.
Right. Yeah, and you really do a great job in the book of going into that too. And for those of y'all who are maybe new to this whole debate, or maybe you've heard the other side of this debate, the arguments that, well, diagnosis is improved, or people have been reclassified. People we used to diagnose as mentally retarded, we're now reclassifying as autism, or the definition of autism is expanded. I mean, these are the three main arguments to deny that there even is an epidemic, and JB goes through each one of these and just really fillets them wide open. Makes a great case that all three of those arguments don't work. So I recommend y'all read that. Read that chapter for sure. JB, we only got maybe 4 or 5 minutes left, but I want you to touch on, because folks that are trying to wrap their head around this, you know, and they go search on the internet, they're going to hear from 2 or 3 or 4 doctors like Dr. Offit or some of the talking heads, and you go into this in the book how two men who are often quoted in 8 of the studies that they always point to say vaccines are safe, two of those men, one's a whistleblower and one's an embezzler, and then you talk about 2 or 3 guys that are always interviewed on TV, on CNN or wherever, the rampant conflict of interest. So touch on the other side and what they point to from studies and from the conflict interest standpoint in the few minutes we have left.
Yeah, I mean, I try to use the tobacco analogy because everybody understands that there were advertisements all over about doctors recommending tobacco. And, you know, the tobacco industry created something called the Tobacco Research Committee that they funded research that tried to distract the topic. And they hired, you know, researchers out of Harvard and other mainstream medical to perform these experiments that then, you know, basically threw noise out there. This idea of creating doubt is what keeps good people from jumping into the debate. And the very same PR firm, Hill & Knowlton, that was behind the tobacco industry, is behind the pharma industry on the autism vaccine thing. And they have very clear lines of communication between themselves and certain doctors who are in the press seemingly on a weekly basis talking about this topic. Paul Offit is the most famous one by far. It's just insane to me. This is a man who literally made millions of dollars developing a vaccine. He's very old with Merck. He's made himself rich from Merck, and yet he's the spokesperson on the vaccine autism topic, and he simply dismisses everything that we have to say as if none of it could possibly be true. And that's his job. And he's, you know, he's supported by the media because he's a, you know, he's a positive spokesperson for the pharmaceutical industry, and the pharmaceutical industry pays a lot of the media's bills. And it's this virtuous cycle where the truth never comes out. And it's really unfortunate, but we've just seen this movie so many times. I try to make this point to people. When in the history of mankind as a product that someone was making caused harm in a population of people who start talking about it, like us parents are doing, and there are literally hundreds of thousands of us around the world and tens of thousands of us in the United States all saying the same thing, when has it ever happened that the profiteer was actually right? No, it doesn't cause harm. When did that ever happen? Lead paint, lead and gasoline, DDT, thalidomide, Biox. I mean, my list could go on for eons. There has never been a time, but there have always been apologists, there have always been spokespeople, and there have always been deniers. But what I think gives me comfort, if you will, that this will ultimately end, is the purity of our message. I mean, I'm literally donating all the money I make from this book to nonprofits, so I'm not making a penny. Parents, we'll never shut up. Yeah. We saw what happened to our children. We know what's true. And now the science is clearly standing behind us. And so I think that, you know, with time, I hope it doesn't take 40 years like it did for tobacco, but with time, I think this truth will completely bear itself out, and we'll have to make massive changes to how we vaccinate children, and we'll hopefully end the autism epidemic, which is the whole, you know, purpose of my book in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm with you. Well, unfortunately, I think we'll look back on this age of massive pharmaceutical / vaccination epidemic we've been under for the past few decades in medicine and just say, wow, that was a dark time in our profession.
I think history will be a harsh judge.
Yeah.
I think history will be a very harsh judge to this time. and that medical professionals continued to inject babies after the science started to become clear that there was neurological damage being done.
Yeah, and that's really my take-home point. Or for my patients, it's going to be, guys, this isn't speculation anymore. This isn't anecdotal. This isn't, you know, a few parents. This isn't just Jenny McCarthy or whoever. This is science. I mean, it's all the above. And read the book, and you'll get the entire picture, and you'll see clearly. Like you said, you'd have to be a very, very close-minded person not to see clearly. So what I'm going to encourage, it's so unfortunate so many parents end up at our clinic because they were fired from their pediatrician. And the thought came to me as I was reading your book that parents should take this book to their pediatrician prior to delivering their baby, as they're basically interviewing. We need to turn this around. The parents need to interview the pediatrician and see if they're qualified enough to take care of their kids. And one of the qualifications needs to be, you need to read J.B. Hanley's book, How to End the Autism Epidemic. And if you won't, then I'm going to fire you. Let's turn the tables.
Yep.
Instead of pediatricians firing parents, let's fire the pediatricians who won't read the science.
Yeah, many parents are actually bringing my book to their pediatrician, which I think is great. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. just sent my book to every state legislator in the country, all 7,400 of them. So
wow.
I hope that moves like that start to get the word out and that we can have an honest conversation. And I keep saying we need the adults in the room to step up.
Okay? Exactly.
I understand the need to prevent infectious disease. No one is saying that we shouldn't strive to do that. But we have to with the facts about the trade-offs. And that's probably the biggest point I would want to leave parents with. The actual risk-benefit of vaccines has been obscured. Okay, that doesn't mean that they don't have benefits. That doesn't mean that the risk-benefit might not be worth it for you and your family. But what I will say is the risk side of that equation has been so obscured it makes it very hard to do the calculation.
Exactly.